got picked on at school for things he couldn't change. He tried his best to play it cool, but in the seventh grade, you either fit right in or you don't fit. That's just the cold hard truth. I wish that I'd have been the friend that Billy never knew. I think it's time we come together, you and I can make a change. Maybe we can make a difference, make the world a better place. Look around and love somebody, we've been hateful long enough. Let the good Lord reunite us to this country that we love's undivided.
Yup. You either go to church or you're gonna go to hell. Get a job and work or you're gonna go to jail. I just kinda wish we didn't think like that. Why's it gotta be all white or all black? And when we gonna learn to try on someone's shoes sometimes?
That's right.
When we gonna start to see from someone else's eyes?
All right, welcome back.
So, whither are we being led, dear comrades? Back to that little article that I wrote last April, Opportunities of Crisis, as a prelude to the remainder of the excerpts from John T. Flynn's The Rockefeller Myth. So back to the present, I wrote more recent and the more recent past. Take, for instance, the recent reference by Derek Bros, ODDTV, Dana Ashley, and others to a 2010 report titled Scenarios for the Future of Technology and International Development. One of those scenario planning, the wargaming exercises brought to us by Dr. Strangelove, the Hudson Institute, the Rand Corporation, Rockefeller Foundation, and so forth. So this was produced by the Rockefeller Foundation and the Global Business Network. That's kind of the top of the food chain for this scenario planning nonsense, the wargaming stuff. In light of the present response to the alleged pandemic, I would direct your attention to the lockstep scenario narrative beginning on page 18. And so I wrote, I think you'll find the resemblances quite uncanny. So the planners plan, but at some point all plans require execution. Friedrich Hayek did a marvelous job in The Road to Serfdom of pointing out the dangers of social planning. Drawing largely on the lessons and examples of World War II, he demonstrated that, and this is a parallel discussion with John T. Flynn's The Roosevelt Myth, drawing largely on the lessons and examples of World War II, he demonstrated that planning leads to totalitarianism, including the end of truth, quote-unquote, an all-encompassing totalitarian propaganda and a corrupt despotic society. So an excerpt from Chapter 2, The Great Utopia. Freedom of thought they regarded as the root evil of 19th century society, and the first of modern planners, St. Simon, even predicted that those who did not obey his proposed planning boards would be treated as cattle. Anyone around the world feeling like cattle these days? I know I sure am. So the planners and their grand plans, their grand schemes, their opportunities of crisis, steering us into a crisis only to tell us. Remember I read the excerpt from Wilson's The New Freedom and how This is one of the age old strategies, you know? Don't you know that some man with eloquent tongue, without conscience, who did not care for the nation, could put this whole country into a flame? What if you could engineer a problem and then introduce this person? Don't you know that this country from one end to the other believes that something is wrong? What an opportunity it would be for some man without conscience to spring up and say, or for bad guys to create their little figurehead, their little puppet, to say, this is the way, follow me, and leads in the path of destruction. Woodrow Wilson, The New Freedom. They call for the emancipation of the generous energies of a people. So, John T. Flynn's The Roosevelt Myth, The Dance of the Crackpots. So this epic plan It would be operated by a California Authority for Land, CAL, which would buy up the idle farms, and the California Authority for Production, CAP, which would take over the idle factories. And so, I mean, this is textbook socialism, but where does it lead? All serviced by a great fleet of trucks and a chain of stores in which would be sold to those employed by these authorities, the clothes and food produced by the CAL and CAP. Of course, there would be a California Authority for Money, CAM, which would float the bond issues to finance all this. The sales tax would be repealed. There would be income taxes on incomes of $5,000 and over. And the tax exemptions for homes and farms valued at less than $3,500. There was more to it, including, of course, a great Central Valley water project for power. All these plans were called crackpot, but Sinclair's was not a crackpot plan. He knew what he was doing. Had he succeeded, he would have created in the body of the capitalist system of California a more or less complete socialist organization operating strictly on the principle of production for use. At a blow, 10 or 15% of California's population would be transferred to a socialist economy. He undoubtedly believed, and he was right, that the success of his plan would gradually enervate and enfeeble the capitalist system. Right. It's Gresham's law, right? The bad drives out the good. Would gradually enervate and enfeeble the capitalist system which contained and supported it, so the parasite would eat out the host, essentially, and that epic would gradually swallow the whole. There were other groups, Major Douglas's Social Credit and Howard Scott's Technocrats, neither of which made much progress, though they did supply to Mr. Roosevelt's great economic staff some of its top dog economists, quote-unquote, and statisticians. The social credit advocates laid out as a principle that the capitalist system does not produce enough money, income, to enable all producers to buy the national product of consumable goods at a profit. Stated differently, you know, this is the too-big-to-fail argument, basically. Stated differently, the customers of the nation do not receive enough money income to purchase at a profit what the employers produce. A powerful argument can be made for this thesis. However, the social credit advocates, and do we hear, I mean, the social credit argument just never seems to go away, does it? The planners love this. Social credit advocates, and today we have a new and sort of somewhat different social credit argument. I digress. The social credit advocates proposed that to correct this deficit in purchasing power, the government would at intervals issue to all the people what they called social dividends, government issued cash to enable them to buy what they needed. Have we seen this lately, dear comrades? It amounted to this, that the government would give to everybody a cash handout at certain periods in the year. And I mentioned it last week, but where is that? This article. Recently. Nope. Where did that go? Where did that go? The latest of the payments. And by the way, again, when we think of, so I'm looking for the, where is that? The fourth. Stimulus payment. Well, I can't find it. Maybe I'll find that later. So that article, fourth stimulus check. When will that? So basically buying people off for pennies and doing it at seemingly arbitrary moments. If you do a little bit of research into operant conditioning, when the incentive or the punishment for that matter seems arbitrary and not at planned regular intervals, then apparently the conditioning is more effective and it's more pervasive and complete. According to the folks like Pavlov and Skinner who have studied this kind of stuff. So if the stimulus payments seem sort of arbitrary, then the socialist buyout or buy-off of people in the effort to save us all from ourselves, or not really, the problems that the opportunists of crisis create, buying us off is accomplished much more effectively and completely at a bargain basement price, if you will. So this sounds familiar, and this is not a new thing. This is page 71, chapter titled The Dance of the Crackpots, of John T. Flynn's The Roosevelt Myth. So the social credit advocates proposed to correct this deficit in purchasing power, the government would at intervals issue to all the people what they called social dividends. Government issued cash to enable them to buy what they needed. It amounted to this, that the government would give to everybody a cash handout at certain periods of the year. But that was a transition. And the progression in which Flynn writes is brilliant. What's coming next is basically that progression. And this is what we're seeing now, 80 years, some 75 or 80 years later. This is actually being realized. Technocracy didn't go underground. It was operating right out in plain sight, because the FDR bureaucracy in particular, if we can call it that, even though that's somewhat disingenuous, did not go away. So, continuing, page 71, the technocrats were the most radical of the new reformers. They insisted that we must have a continental economy, that is, we must unite to the United States, Canada, Mexico, and the Central American countries in order to have a self-sustaining continent. And then what? Because, again, this is a dialectical continuum, not a stopping point. We must then liquidate the democratic system and turn the management of the system over to the only people capable of understanding it, namely the engineers, to whom they later added the economists and other technicians. This was called the Soviet of the engineers. Next, we would abolish the existing money system and base all money on the unit of energy, the erg. Any of this ringing a bell lately? There is more to it, but this is enough. One of the most eminent supporters of technocracy and chief sponsor of the crackpot, Howard Scott, was Mr. Leon Henderson, who was made statistician of the NRA and later economic advisor and research director of the Democratic Party, and finally head of the Office of Price Administration, the OPA, of sad memory during the war. This dance of the crackpots all over Roosevelt's side of the street was playing havoc with his own medicine show. The election year 1936 loomed menacingly ahead. They must be liquidated or composed or appeased or devoured. And someone, aided by fate, did an excellent job of getting all these dervishes to quit their merry hoopla and march along in the ranks of the Great New Deal. See how he's sort of hinting at piercing the veil, if you will? Someone, aided by fate, did an excellent job of getting all these dervishes to quit their merry hoopla and march along in the ranks of the Great New Deal. While Hoover was president, the Treasury and the Department of Justice had been pursuing the Huey Long forces on their income taxes, but when Roosevelt came into power, Justice turned her eyes away. However, when Huey went out on the warpath, Justice once again went to work on Huey and his pals. It has been said the decision to indict him on income tax fraud was made the very day before he died. But he left behind a batch of heirs who knew how to trade on the powers of the departed St. Huey. Huey's organization showed no loss of strength. The Treasury and the Department of Justice went into action, and before long, there were income tax indictments against at least 25 of the Long leaders and henchmen. Richard W. Leash was governor in January 1936. He was reelected by an immense landslide, thus demonstrating the survival of the Long power. But in some mysterious way, the raucous chorus of denunciation of Washington by the Long machine stopped cold. According to Drew Pearson in the Washington Merry-Go-Round column, a Washington reporter saw Marvin McIntyre, Roosevelt's secretary, and said, "Mac, did it ever occur to you that the administration might arrange a rapprochement with the gang in Louisiana? I think I could be of some service to you." McIntyre said, "I think that's already been taken care of." "Then nobody has to worry?" "Nobody," answered Mac. Not long after, the United States attorney asked the United States court to dismiss most of the indictments against the Long crowd. Westbrook Pegler dubbed this the second Louisiana purchase. Harnett Kane, who has written a brilliant account of this episode, says, quote, a judicial bargain basement was set up, and men, by paying $1,000 fines, were freed of charges which might have brought them years in prison. There's more, but I'll leave that there. The planners, the technocrats, what of them? Let's get back to that. Skipping forward, page 155 in the Roosevelt myth. The chapter titled "The Dance of the Philosophers." Again, backing up just a bit for context, page 154. But the planners have something else in mind. The first thing they would do is destroy the freedom of the system. The next thing would be to socialize about one-fourth of it. Obviously, this would not be planning to make our economic system work. It would be planning to substitute another one. These planners mean that inside the state, a great aggregation of bureaus must be set up with some totalitarian overall bureau to decide what will be produced and how much and who will produce it and who will be allowed to produce and where and at what price he will get his materials and at what price he will sell them and what he will pay for labor and the conditions under which labor will work and so on. That is textbook technocracy, is it not? In foreign trade, the business would be handled precisely as it was in Hitler's Germany, through huge state cartels, which will, if possible, unite with similar cartels from other countries and great international cartels. And doesn't this sound vaguely familiar, dear comrades? Stick around, we'll be right back.
Homeowners, are you in foreclosure, expecting to be served with a foreclosure lawsuit, or suspect your lender has coerced you into an illegal mortgage transaction? A huge number of mortgages made in the last 10 years have legal issues and are possibly defective. State laws and the U.S. Supreme Court have upheld that defective mortgage documents are grounds for foreclosure defense and for counterclaims in favor of the homeowner. If your mortgage has been sold or assigned since closing the loan, it may be defective and you may be paying the wrong party, and the lender may not have standing or the right to foreclose or collect payments under the law. If you would like to know if your mortgage is legal or not, or know if you are paying the right party, we can help. Our initial consultations are free of charge. We are not attorneys. We are legal researchers and work closely with experienced lawyers who know how to help you find the evidence to help you keep your home. Call toll-free 1-855-2-KEEP-IT. That's 1-855-2-KEEP-IT today.
Hey gang, Patrick Slattery here with an important message that is pertinent to anyone who shops for groceries, eats food, or just has an inquisitive mind like myself. What I'm about to introduce you to is a segment of our food culture that has been kept so low profile to the American public that virtually no one is aware of how dominant it is on our refrigerator and cupboard shelves. What I'm talking about is the kosher certification industry and a new app, Koshertified, that delivers a comprehensive education on all aspects regarding this little-known practice. After reviewing this app, I found that it is useful for practically anyone who purchases food, regardless of their religious faith or identity. Its database of products not kosher certified is a win-win convenience for all food-conscious people. So why not check out thekosherquestion.com or click on the link at nationalbugle.com and see how modifying your grocery shopping with the Koshertified app can make a huge difference for your future.
For over 20 years now, Extendabite has proven time and again, it really works. Here is a testimonial from Amazon.com. I received an arterial switch at birth. In my mid-20s, I started getting slight runs of NSVT. Nothing too serious, but enough to cause worry. I started taking Extendivite a little over 2 years ago, and it helped cut the palpitations and NSVT down drastically. This isn't a cure-all supplement. I strongly recommend a good diet and exercise to aid in any heart troubles you may be having, and I strongly recommend giving Extendivite a try. Extendivite is only $69.95 for a two-month supply. To order, call 1-877-928-8822 or visit heartdrop.com. That's HEARTDROP.com.
Extend your life with Extendivite.
It's the good life. Full of fun seems to be the ideal. Yes, the good life lets you hide all the sadness you feel. You won't really fall in love, 'cause you can't take the chance. So be honest with yourself. Don't try to fake romance. It's the good life to be free and explore the unknown. Like the heartaches when you learn you must face them alone. Please remember, I still want you. And in case you wonder why, well, just wake up, kiss that good life goodbye.
Welcome back. All right, I'm going to back up a little bit further, actually. I'm going to start from the beginning of the chapter titled The Dance of the Philosophers. I think it's instructive and informative, and you also hear echoes and reverberations of historical accounts like that of Hayek's Road to Serfdom. Things we're not supposed to read or know, dear comrades. We're not supposed to, you know, we can have visual pattern recognition and long-term memory augmented or replaced, guys like Greg Kurzweil say. We shouldn't, you know, those pesky things, bad guys need to enhance those with things like artificial intelligence and technology so that they can see patterns, that, you know, all of the important patterns. They can have all of the actionable intelligence and sort of hoard that to themselves, but make sure that the plebs have none. The Dance of the Philosophers, Part 1, The Planners. We must now have a look, and this is page 148 of John T. Flynn's The Roosevelt Myth. We must now have a look at some of the men who were the managers of that sparkling and seductive idea which danced across Roosevelt's desk as he wrestled with the grave crisis in his fortunes in 1938. And again, back and back and back we go in history. These ideas were not new. This is a point that Hayek makes, others have made, Flynn is making, continuing. Roosevelt had cried out in despair to his cabinet for help. Quote, "No one tells me what to do about it. What is to be done, dear comrades?" As a matter of fact, he was not in the habit of purchasing his magic rabbits from his cabinet. Old Man Hull and Big Jim Farley, Dan Roper, Harry Woodring, and the aging Swanson never dreamed of being in the rabbit business. Cummings had produced one, the court plan, and it had bitten the master. Certainly, Morgenthau was no breeder of magic rabbits, nor even Miss Perkins, nor Ike's, who, after all, was just an old-fashioned progressive who had been fighting the power trust and was for soil conservation and really belonged to the first New Deal, to which he had added an illusion of revolution by his vitriolic tongue. Wallace, of course, could promote rabbits, and before he ended, squirrels. But at the moment, he was more bewildered than anything else. It was always from the rapidly shifting membership of the kitchen cabinet that Roosevelt got his great ideas. And so it proved now. Perhaps the most influential member of this group was always Rexford Guy Tugwell. Though his influence was most powerful indirectly through those whose minds he influenced. Ah, the influence. He more than any other man in this orbit represented the true form of the Third New Deal, which was now about to be born. Tugwell came from a New York State farm, went from high school to the Wharton School of Business, and then began as a teacher at the University of Pennsylvania, the University of Washington, and finally Columbia. Ray Molley, who knew him at Columbia, drafted him for Roosevelt's Brain Trust in 1932, and when Roosevelt was inaugurated, Tugwell was made Assistant Secretary of Agriculture under Henry Wallace. Perhaps no colder heart ever beat for the common man than Tugwell's. Well, that's the way planners are, after all, right? Unlike some of his colleagues, he was in no sense queer. He differed from most of them in that he had a first-rate mind and wrote well in a severely cold style with a painfully cultivated formality. He perfected himself in the fine art of being contemptuous. At college, he looked at the world and found it distinctly third class, not at all the kind he would have made. He burst into song in a poem called The Dreamer, indicating his general intention with reference to his own tawdry country as follows, quote, "I am strong, I am big and well made, I am sick of a nation's stenches, I am sick of propertied czars. I have dreamed my great dream of their passing. I have gathered my tools and my charts. My plans are finished and practical. I shall roll up my sleeves, make America over." Sure enough, here he was in Washington with his charts and his tools. We'll be right back.
You are tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
The reviews for Extendivite are amazing. Amazon customer, It's amazing. I just ordered my second bottle. In 1 month, my blood pressure dropped significantly. I no longer get chest pain after I exercise. The reviews are spot on. My target is to get off of BP meds, and if it keeps going like this, I see a light at the end of the tunnel. Amazon customer, Extendivite works great. This product has made my blood pressure and cholesterol stable. I highly recommend it. Amazon customer, excellent herbal formula. I've been using it to keep my cardiovascular system fine-tuned. Extendivite is only $69.95 for a 2 month supply. To order, call 1-877-928-8822 or visit heartdrop.com. That's HEARTDROP.com.
Extend your life with Extendivite.
Corporate media dominates the American opinion. Finding independent voices that counter this avalanche is becoming increasingly difficult. With the endless corruption running rampant throughout our government, independent voices are needed more than ever to battle the offensive against our freedoms and liberties. As a listener of RBN, no one understands this concept better than you. Now it's up to you to do your part. The time has come for you to take action and begin broadcasting the truth to hundreds or thousands of people every month. Sound impossible? Quite the contrary. With pointed slogans from LibertyStickers.com, you can reach countless sleeping Americans unaware that they live in a real-life wonderland. LibertyStickers.com has a huge inventory of political bumper stickers and messages that reflect the truth about our government, our politicians, and the future of America. With so many in stock, there's one perfect for you. Visit us today at LibertyStickers.com. Again, that's LibertyStickers.com. Do your part. Your voice is important. Let it be heard.
Here at Republic Broadcasting Network, we have been building our online store. Well, we have been focusing on bringing you the best talk show host in the country. Here at Republic Broadcasting Network, we also want our listeners to have products they can use every day and in times of emergency. We have added new products each week to our store. Your support of this network, plus products at the best prices, is a win-win situation. Check out our new store. Go to our website, republicbroadcasting.org, and click on the online store located at the top of our website. Together, we can continue to grow RBN and help our listeners prepare for the future. Go to republicbroadcasting.org and click on our online store or call us.
800-724-2719, extension 3. 800-724-2719, extension 3.
When you were here before, you couldn't look you in the eye. You're just like an angel. Your skin makes me cry. You flow like a feather in a beautiful world. I wish I was special. You're so very special. But I'm a
one more reminder back to the article that I wrote last April. The planners plan, but at some point all plans require execution. Friedrich Hayek did a marvelous job in The Road to Serfdom of pointing out the dangers of social planning, drawing largely on the lessons and examples of World War II. And those were not, you know, original. As he points out, this was a result of the prevailing literature of the day, the philosophers, the philosopher kings, and, you know, again, opportunities of crisis and so forth, hence the title of this piece that I wrote. So Hayek demonstrated that planning leads to totalitarianism, including the end of truth, quote-unquote, an all-encompassing totalitarian propaganda in a corrupt despotic society. And that little excerpt from Chapter 2, The Great Utopia, freedom of thought they regarded as the root evil of 19th century society, and the first of modern planners, St. Simon, even predicted that those who did not obey his proposed planning boards would be treated as cattle. These people feel that way. They act that way. Back to John T. Flynn's The Roosevelt Myth, The Dance of the Philosophers and the Planners, and in this case, Rexford Guy Tugwell. So, Tugwell's the dreamer. This is his idea. I shall roll up my sleeves, make America over. And sure enough, here he was in Washington with his charts and his tools. Only his tools were men. And he didn't think much of them either. As an administrator in the agricultural department, he did not get far, due chiefly to his bad manners. But that's what, you know, that's how planners are, because they have a loathsome disdain for their fellow man who is of inferior intellect, or so they think. Farmers who called on him were treated with scorn. But the darling targets of his contumely were congressmen and senators. He quarreled with everyone, save, of course, the president, the source of his present power. He had to be got out of Washington because of the trouble he stirred. And in due time, like many another New Dealer, he hid his scorn under a bushel while he crawled onto the payroll of one of those great enemies of the common man, a big Puerto Rican sugar corporation. And, you know, this is, again, this is sort of a common theme. I think of guys like Murray Strong, for example. Later he would be named governor of Puerto Rico. Despite all of this, it was nevertheless this well-dressed, almost dandified, contumelious, and disliked scholar who, contumelious, excuse me, as much as anyone else, indicated the lines upon which the much bedeviled and bewildered leader of the New Deal would travel. Before following this trail further, we must reconstruct in our minds the state of political opinion on that side of controversy called the left. Nothing has confused so perfectly the crisis of Mr. Roosevelt's various New Deals as their obscurity about the meaning of a lot of words such as socialism, communism, fascism, liberal, conservative, and so on. We must clear this up for ourselves before we can see with clarity just what happened in Washington in the next 2 years. And again, someone like Flynn coming, you know, with his background, coming from where he did politically, ideologically speaking, is what I would call an unimpeachable witness, similar to someone like, say, an Andrew Breitbart, comes to the discussion or comes to the table and or the podium or the microphone with a very unvarnished clarity on the subject matter, because he has awoken on the one side to the propaganda, wandered over to the other flavor of Kool-Aid only to realize obviously more propaganda, and then has transcended the mythos. And so he comes to us with an unvarnished clarity. So definitions, defining terms, right? So he writes, it goes back a long way and begins with the socialists. There were all sorts of schools of socialists. And what's ironic, I think, here is that he doesn't mention there is no account of the Fabians. Not really. I digress. But in the United States, the kind that acquired such a large influence over the minds of Americans were those democratic socialists led by Eugene Debs, Maurice Hillquit, and Norman Thomas. They were profoundly devoted to the ideal of human freedom. Again, this echoes of Hayek and so many others. They believed they could, by gradual series of alterations, the gradualists, in the structure of our society, create a truly democratic world And again, you know, democratic socialism, gradualism, Fabian reverberations. They believe they could, by gradual series of alterations in the structure of our society, create a truly democratic world in which all men would enjoy not merely freedom, but plenty. Ah, yes, the new freedom. Freedom from want. They believe this could never be achieved under the system of private property and profit, even though that was a system that had produced more freedom from want than any other system historically. They did not advocate revolution, but rather a gradual acquisition by the state of all the great utilities, power, transportation, communications, and the great basic industries like coal, oil, steel, etc. From this point on, this partly socialized state would expand its acquisition of all other economic activities to whatever extent seemed feasible. They dreamed of a cooperative commonwealth in which all, and that, yeah, now it's you know, one of the other names of it is the collective commons. Like, again, the, what's it called? And, you know, the guy, the zero marginal cost society, Jeremy Rifkin, you know, the, full title of the book, The Zero Marginal Cost Society, The Internet of Things, The Collaborative Commons, excuse me, Collaborative Commons, and The Eclipse of Capitalism. That's one of the other names for it, the Collaborative Commons, the Cooperative Commonwealth, in which all would share suitability in the abundance created by a great productive organism owned by the people, so-called. This would end poverty, you know, and so now he's going to get into Stuart Chase here in a minute, speaking of control without ownership, and this X thing, this X factor. This would end poverty, ignorance, and crises. The Socialist Party once polled 1 million votes, and even in 1932, Norman Thomas polled over 800,000 votes. But the influence of the Socialist Party cannot be measured by the number of votes it got. Its philosophy penetrated deeply into the thinking of large numbers of men who never voted a socialist ticket, and particularly into those groups loosely described as intellectuals. The Russian Revolution was essentially a socialist revolution. Lenin preferred to call his government a communist government, though the term meant very much the same. In fact, Russia became known as the Union of Socialist Soviet Republics. However, Lenin and his colleagues, and that's the technocratic way, right? However, Lenin and his colleagues completely discarded the idea of a democratically controlled society, and instead set up, and that was led by the international industrialist, right? The super capitalist, as someone like Larry McDonald might say. McDonald, I guess, combining McDonald with Anthony Sutton. Lenin and his colleagues completely discarded the idea of a democratically controlled society and instead set up what they called the dictatorship of the proletariat, which was in fact nothing more than a dictatorship by the Communist Party, a tiny fraction of the population. It was in fact a dictatorship by an elite, the so-called experts. That's the technocratic way, in the socialist organization. And this it has remained. This dictatorship, so complete, so cruel, so savage, in fact, produced a sense of defeat or at least frustration in the minds of great numbers who had nursed the old socialist democratic dream. This shocking example of the first socialist state dampened the tolerance with which the socialist dream was held by many people who never embraced socialism, but were willing to give it a free voice in the discussion of public problems. On the other hand, semi-socialist states rose all over Europe. Social democracies, they were called. They were part socialist, part capitalist, part parliamentary. but with all the defects of the European parliamentary system critically exaggerated. Perhaps it would be better to say that systems which were at least three-fourths capitalists were being operated by socialist governments. For most of the countries of Europe, for a while, at least socialist prime ministers and partly socialist ministries were running the show. However, the most important thing that rose out of all this was a new approach that made a tremendous appeal to many of the same intellectuals who had dallied with socialism. I say new, yet it was not really new. Men had been flirting with the idea in Germany since the days of Fitta. Again, this echoes of Hayek's Road to Serfdom. And what of Fitta? And what of Russell's glowing endorsement of Fitta's ideals? Men had been flirting with the idea in Germany since the days of Fitta, who might be said to be the father of the theory of a planned capitalism. The idea was that it would be sufficient to nationalize the banks, the railroads, all means of transport, the mines, and a few great basic industries, perhaps not even all of them. This would leave all the factories, stores, amusements, farms, etc., in the hands of private owners. Actually, such a society would be about one-fourth socialist and three-fourths privately owned or capitalist. However, in this society, the state would assume the responsibility for making the whole work. It would hold itself responsible for the well-being of all the citizens, which echoes Thomas McNeice, right? The economic well-being for the American people had been transferred heavily to the executive branch. It would hold itself responsible for the well-being of all the citizens, their protection from the hazards of life, poverty, sickness, age, etc., and to make the whole work continuously without occasional breakdowns, the state would set up certain great planning agencies or boards, which would continuously study and observe the functioning of the economic system and make plans covering production, prices, distribution, financing, profits, wages, hours, etc. Thus, we would have what was in fact a planned capitalism, with the state responsible for the planning and for ensuring the carrying out of its plans through great government bureaus, armed with the necessary powers to enforce compliance. This was the perfect haven for great masses of intellectuals, students, teachers, lawyers, politicians, writers, journalists, and others who had flirted timidly with socialism and communism, but who did not dare admit they were communists or socialists, because that would carry with it a certain ostracism in the schools, the journals, in the professions, and in business. There was indeed a good deal of tolerance for the idea of planning our capitalist system, even in the most conservative circles. And a man could support publicly and with vehemence this system of the planned economy without incurring the odium of being too much of a radical for polite and practical society. There was only one trouble with it. This was what Mussolini had adopted, the planned capitalist state. And he gave it a name, fascism. Then came Hitler and adopted the same idea. And remember, these people were groomed by, again, the oligarchic, you know, industrialist class. This is something that Ivy Lee told Congress before his untimely demise. You know, the interviewing of Hitler and his compatriots, his cohorts. Then came Hitler and adopted the same idea. His party was called the Nazi Party, which was derived from the initials of its true name. But it was dedicated to fascism, you know, the National Socialist Party. Mussolini and Hitler, of course, realized that a system like this, which undertakes to impose a vast complex of decrees upon a people while subjecting them to confiscatory taxes to support the immense activities of the state, cannot be operated save by an absolute government that has the power to enforce compliance. Actually, this system had been spread over Europe. For nearly 70 years, all the countries in Europe, with Germany in the lead, had been experimenting with the baleful idea of the security state. Again, echoes of Hayek, Chapter 9, Security and Freedom, for example. The state which attempts to provide its people with jobs and protection from all the hazards of life. After World War I, the dominance of this idea over the populations of every European state became complete, and every state in Europe was riding, before World War II, hell-bent for bankruptcy under the impossible burden of meeting those obligations. We'll be right back.
Homeowners, if your lender has gone out of business or sold your transaction to another lender or servicer, you may be the victim of a wrongful foreclosure resulting in the loss of your home. If you've already lost your home, are in foreclosure, or even in good standing, you can challenge the mortgage transaction's illegal issue and your property can be restored to you, and your foreclosure can be stopped or reversed and the mortgage transaction declared unenforceable. State laws, U.S. title codes, the Uniform Commercial Codes, and U.S. Supreme Court rulings have upheld that defective mortgage documentations can reverse or stop foreclosures and enforce property title claims in favor of the homeowner. We are having successes in stopping the process of foreclosure, the enforcement of the foreclosure judgments, the sale of property, and evictions after the sale. We are not attorneys, and we don't give legal advice. We are a professional team of legal researchers, providing forensic mortgage audits and expert witnesses. We have the knowledge to produce the evidence and enforce laws regarding your legal issues. We've been in business for 12 years without a complaint. Consultations are free, and we provide a free title search to confirm if your mortgage has legal defects. Please call 855-253-3748. 855-2-KEEP-IT today.
Folks, we're living in a world the likes of which we've never perceived any clearer than we do now. The plan for global governance has been in the works for generations and would have likely been achieved by now but for the fact that the globalists left open their Achilles heel. With all their tools, Federal Reserve System, fiat currency, no child left behind, and then Common Core education introduced to our schools to dumb us down, vaccines, pharmaceuticals to lobotomize us, GMO foods, insertion of compromised or bought and paid for politicians, judges, mainstream media propaganda, all pieced together like a puzzle designed to ultimately bring the world under submission. But with all their strategy, they forgot one thing: knowledge. And knowledge is power. With knowledge, their bombardment is nullified. Folks, with that, as brilliant and knowledgeable as you've become, among the wisest audience of any radio audience in the world, and you are, I want you to take a moment to reflect and ask yourself, how much of that knowledge did I obtain from Republic Broadcasting Network? How high has my consciousness been raised since I've been a listener? How fast am I now able to discriminate truth from fake news by being a Republic Broadcasting listener? How clear am I now able to see the world since I've been listening to RBN? Ask yourselves those questions, folks. Then ask yourself, what is that knowledge worth to me? Like my morning coffee, how would I survive without it? A voice of truth in a sea of lies. Do we not all need to make sure it survives? Like public broadcasting, we are now finding we can only survive with listener support. Censorship, advertisers being attacked, truth itself being attacked. It's the only way through this. We at Republic Broadcasting humbly ask you to become a supporter. Look at your budget and make a determination of what Republic Broadcasting is worth to you and what you can afford on a monthly basis. Go to republicbroadcasting.org and pledge 20, 30, 40, 50, if possible, 100 a month or more if it's affordable. Click the donate button and become a regular monthly donor. Assure both us and yourself that Republic Broadcasting truth will continue to flow like that morning coffee. The network thanks you.
Welcome back. backed up a little further than I intended, so I'll probably have to continue this tomorrow, a few more pages. But I think it's fascinating to look at this. So this is the same kind of course that we have been embarked on here in America in post-World War II days. So Flynn writes, whatever it was the direct opposite of liberalism, that is classical liberalism. It was an attempt somewhere midway between communism and capitalism to organize a stable society and to do it by setting up a state equipped with massive powers over the lives and fortunes of the citizens. This may be a wise dispensation, but it is the negation of the liberal philosophy which for decades has been fighting to emancipate the people from the tyranny of all-powerful states. And it's interesting when you start thinking about it, the way these things are put forth, it's as though, you know, it's seemingly arbitrary, like we all, you know, agree on this, and this is something that just emerges as the natural progression of logical thought and the betterment of society, when nothing could be further from the truth. Behind the scenes, you have the hidden persuaders, as Vance Packard might say, influencing. They've already gamed and strategized this through, you know, Dr. Strangelove's Hudson Institute, the RAND Corporation, their game theory and scenario planning, their war gaming, making you think and believe it was your idea all along, when in reality nothing could be further from the truth. You know, you go down this fanciful trail, this primrose path of destruction, as a result of these tall tales that they tell in scenario planning fashion. And, you know, you end up thinking that this idea of the technocratic elite running things is the natural progression of the betterment of society, and this was my idea all along. So back to Hayek's Road to Serfdom for a moment, Chapter 10, Why the Worst Get on Top. Remember this? If, however, a political dictator had to rely entirely on those whose uncomplicated and primitive instincts happen to be very similar, their number would scarcely give sufficient weight to their endeavors. He will have to increase their numbers by converting more to the same simple creed. Here comes in the second negative principle of selection. He will be able to obtain the support of all the docile and gullible, who have no strong convictions of their own but are prepared to accept a ready-made system of values if it is only drummed into their ears sufficiently loudly and frequently. It would be those whose vague and imperfectly formed ideas are easily swayed and whose passions and emotions are readily aroused who will thus swell the ranks of the totalitarian party. Today I would call them the COVID Enforcement Brigade, and we're seeing their numbers swell, aren't we? Follow the science. Really? Let's define terms. That'll conclude today's broadcast. As always, it truly is an honor and a pleasure. I hope it was informative. Take care. God bless. We'll catch you on the other side.
Are you sick of censorship? TLB Talk is the cure. TLB stands for Truth, Liberty, and Balance. We are the newest and most unique social media platform to hit the internet. We were built out of necessity because Big Tech, Big Pharma, and Big Brother are out of control. The only thing bigger than them is when we, the people, are united. With that vision, TLB Talk was born. Our battlefield is in cyberspace. The battle we're in can be won by clicks of buttons and voting with your wallet. TLB Talk has no hidden agendas, no corporate funding, and we do not sell, trade, or give away any of your information. Our platform runs off of generous donations of members and merchandise profits. So please, check out our site. It's the best around. And be sure to stop by our store. It's loaded with items that'll have you feeling a sense of member pride and victory. Come unite with us today at TLBTalk.com and join the social media revolution.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.